It is Monday, September the 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, Russia's Putin deploying troops to Syria.
We know that he's planning in his new airbase to put somewhere between 1,000 and 2,500 on the ground.
Also ahead, Pope Francis leaves the U.S. after a whirlwind tour of three cities, plus violence in the CAR, and a rock star returns to his country music roots. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Tensions over the conflict in Syria are expected to be high on the agenda today when President Obama and Russian leader Vladimir Putin hold their first face-to-face talks. Well, it's been about a year. The two leaders will meet in New York on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Ahead of that meeting, Putin, for the second time in a week, addressed Russia's expanding military role in Syria in an interview recorded in Moscow and aired Sunday here in the U.S. Mr. Putin told CBS's network 60 Minutes that Russia intends to support its longtime ally, embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. But he said Russia will not participate in any Syrian ground action against Islamic State extremists in Syria at this time. Earlier Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry met with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov in what the State Department said was a bid to lay groundwork for the president's talks with Mr. Putin.
This is the beginning of a genuine effort to see if there is a way to deconflict, but also to find a way forward that will be effective.
And for some perspective on all of this, International Edition's Victor Beatty speaks with University of Denver scholar Jonathan Adelman, who says there are a couple of key issues which are important.
One is that the United States efforts, the American efforts over there, have just not paid off. I mean, we spent $500 million training a group of moderate secularists. And we've thus far had 5 to 10 of them go over there, and then of the more recent batch that was sent, that's something like 30 or 40% of them went over to the other side. So we need to rethink our policy and realize that Putin has done something very interesting that is not getting enough commentary. It's not just that he's going to fight ISIS, and it's not just that he's going to, you know, keep Bashar Assad in power, both of which is important to him. But there's a third thing, which is that although he is going to be connecting with some of the Iranian militias, at the very same moment, Russia is still, although not a superpower like the United States, much more powerful than Iran is militarily, and therefore this also can be seen subtly as an effort by Russia to, at the same moment they're working with Iran, to forestall Iran's bid for dominance in the Middle East. So it's complicated.
Yes, and Mr. Putin said that Russia was not planning to put any boots on the ground, at least not now. Interesting statement.
Right. We know that he's planning in his new airbase to put somewhere between 1,000 and 2,500 on the ground. And given the fact that the Russian troops are, although perhaps not at the American level, but they're at a decent level, they're certainly at a much better level than the Iranian forces, that backed Shiite forces, they could be a significant factor. Plus, if you throw in the airplanes and so forth, it's not just Bashar is going to stay in power forever at this rate, unfortunately. It very much may well be that Russia is back, and this is the greatest evidence of what they've been doing with Egypt, what they've been doing with Jordan, what they're doing with Saudi Arabia, and with the Israelis. They're back, and that is not good news for the administration.
It was announced in Baghdad that Russian military officials are working with counterparts from Iran, Syria, and Iraq on intelligence and security cooperation to counter Islamic State. Obviously, they've filled the vacuum left by the U.S.
Absolutely, and it wasn't necessary. And I think it's shameful when we see the hundreds of thousands of people who have to migrate. We see ISIS go and execute, you know, hundreds and or thousands of people, and the Syrians go ahead and callously kill 240,000 civilians. I think it's a tragedy in human rights, and I think it's a tragedy for our position in the Middle East, because the Sunni Arab states wanted to be with the United States. They still do. They just feel that they might as well deal with the Russians. They're not thrilled, but they don't see an alternative.
Israel launched some airstrikes into Syria aimed at Syrian army positions. Obviously, Israel is concerned about what's going on in Syria.
Oh, absolutely. There are al-Nusra forces right next on the Golan Heights within a mile or two of Israel. And you can see that's why Netanyahu is speaking to Putin, because he wants to clarify this. The last thing the Israelis want is to have an armed confrontation with the Russians. But at the same time, they don't want the forces that are opposed to them and the same forces opposed to the United States to gain power from this. So it's really become a very complicated situation.
Jonathan Edelman, a Russia scholar and professor at the Joseph Korbel School of International Studies. That's at the University of Denver. He was speaking with International Edition's Victor Beatty. And as we just heard, the UN General Assembly opens its annual debate later today in New York, and it is expected that there will be a lot of discussion of the Islamic State group, also known as ISIL, and how to combat, in general, violent extremism. VOA's Pam Dawkins is in New York, where she speaks with Richard Stengel. He is the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs.
Wanted to talk to you about the State Department efforts to counter violent extremism. And of course, this is going to be a big issue at the on the sidelines of the United Nations General Assembly. What's going to be the message at UNGA?
Well, the message at UNGA is a follow-up to the President's Summit on countering violent extremism that the White House had last year, I believe in February. And since that time, we've been very, very focused on it. And violent extremism, as you know, is a global problem. In fact, it's an increasingly global problem. So the idea is that the president wants to convene world leaders to really focus on this at UNGA. And so there's a kind of more kinetic aspect to it, which is focusing on anti-ISIL, and then there's a larger, broader effort, which we call CVE, countering violent extremism, which has all kinds of manifestations, education, civil society, media. So that it will be a very broad focus.
Specifically, what are some of the aspects that you hope to discuss with countering violent extremism in meetings with heads of states from other countries, and how do you hope to use this as a follow-up to the president's earlier initiative?
Well, again, one of the sets of things that we're focused on is the globalization of ISIL, or Daesh, as we call it, which is the Arabic name. So there will be conversations with world leaders in those countries where ISIL is actually growing and are creating their own kind of markets there. So that's one thing. Then there's the kind of, again, not softer so much, but the kind of countering violent extremism that has to do with educational exchanges, with programs where we deal with people who are returning back to their community, former fighters, the rehabilitation of young men and women who may have actually gone and fought for an extremist group. So it runs that whole gamut of hard to soft.
Are you seeing any success in efforts to counter violent extremists in the U.S. social media campaigns, which you mentioned there had been some initial criticism that some of the U.S. campaigns may have been having the opposite effect?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that's under me as Undersecretary for Public Diplomacy is the Center for Strategic Counterterrorism Communications, which was set up under Secretary Clinton to counter al-Qaeda messaging, and then it morphed into a full-time counter-ISIL messaging machine. And as you mentioned, ISIL is very sophisticated in social media, but actually I think the scales are shifting. I mean, if you look at what the volume of messaging that they are doing, and not just U.S. messaging to counter it, but messaging by Muslims around the world, that share is actually growing. So I actually always say that we're not the best messenger for our message. Obviously, a lot of people who are attracted to ISIL are anti-U.S. So part of what we do at CSCC is to enlist third-party groups, non-governmental organizations, other media businesses to balance that noxious flow of messaging that comes from ISIL.
That was Richard Stengel. He is the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Public Diplomacy and Public Affairs, and he was speaking with VOA's Pam Dawkins. Also in the news, Pope Francis is in the air on his way back to Rome now. He has been in the United States for the last few days. He was meeting with President Obama, speaking before U.S. lawmakers. He also spoke before world leaders at the United Nations General Assembly, spending some time with the homeless as well as children in each stop along his way, both here in Washington as well as in New York and Philadelphia. At almost every occasion, the Pope spoke of a world that is dangerous, he said, on so many levels, where many are carrying out atrocities in the name of hatred and religion.
Our world is increasingly a place of violent conflict, hatred, and brutal atrocities, committed even in the name of God and of religion. We know that no religion is immune from forms of individual delusion or ideological extremism.
While in New York, the Pope visited the site of the 2001 terrorist attacks. There and at many other stops during the time in the U.S., Pope Francis spoke of forgiving those who do us harm. Even with messages of religious tolerance, such as the Pope's, there persists in the U.S. and elsewhere a distrust of Muslims. While this appears to be growing, there is a group of young people who are part of a group here in the U.S. known as Youth Lead. Their goal is to erase hatred. Youth Lead's founder and executive director, Janet Penn, joins us now. Janet, tell us about the young people with whom you work.
They don't know a world without 9/11. That's just the frame that they see the lenses through. So every one of the kids that are brown-skinned, when they go to the airport, somebody in their family is pulled aside. And, you know, the Hindu kids, the Muslim kids, it doesn't matter who they are. So that's just the fact of their life. You know, when I was growing up, it was get under your desk because there were air raid drills, and literally we had a cedar closet in our house that had canned peas in it.
Mm-hmm. As did we, right.
Right, mm-hmm. and no, what were those canned peas going to do us in a cedar closet? But that was the shadow that we lived under. But the world itself, the information that we had wasn't global the way it is now, and I think that's a huge difference, that the kids live in a world where our economy is globalized, information is globalized, and so they're just a whole lot more aware at an earlier age of the world around them. I don't know if you actually got to see it. Our young people were featured on a Nick News show. The show is entitled Free to Believe or Not.
Right.
And one of the young men, Christian, actually said, you know, on camera, you know, I came in and I had a mild case of Islamophobia. I didn't know any Muslims. I'd never talked to them. And all I knew was what I saw in the media. And then, you know, I got to meet all these kids, and, you know, many of them were Muslim, and it's like there's a name, there's a face, there's a we share this in common, oh, no, I don't like this. It's a human being. And I think that's the piece that most people don't have now that this group provides.
In the material I was reading, I kept reading a great deal about interfaith bridges and referring to, building interfaith bridges,
mm-hmm.
referring to your group. But not everyone is necessarily from a faith-based background, are they not?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why we changed the name to Youth Lead, because, A, it represents that young people really are making the decisions. They're not just being told, you should have this discussion and here are the questions. They're being given the skills to say, how do you ask questions that seek to understand somebody, especially when you know you're not going to agree with them? And it also acknowledges that across differences, you know, for some it's religious, for some it's gender, for some it's race, and that it's much more inclusive of the human family and not, you know, necessarily the religious family.
You know, no matter how much groups like yours and others want to bridge these gaps, the gaps still exist. I guess they must know that. Is that daunting at all?
Well, say more about what you mean by the gaps.
Well, you continue to hear about groups working for better, and that's very important. I
mm-hmm.
think almost anyone with a level head would agree. But there are always groups that seem to be working the other direction, to
mm-hmm.
be divisive, that want to not particularly care
yeah.
for one another. And that's,
right.
I guess that's what I'm referring to.
Sure. Well, I think one of the beauty of, and the reason I love working with teenagers, is that there's a lot of hope and possibility. The world is in front of you. And I remember feeling that as a young person. I remember the sayings that were up on my wall when I was 16. A young Israeli woman came up to me. I gave a talk at a large mosque in Boston, and she said, well, what do you do with these, exactly your question, there's these extremists that are fomenting hate? And I say, look, the majority of people just want to live their lives. And what we need to do is to strengthen the voice of those of us in the middle who aren't looking to foment hate and who aren't necessarily looking to change the world. And what would happen if instead of there being 150 teens who were trained to understand how to ask questions and be willing to accept that people have very different points of view even though we disagree with them, and in spite of that say, okay, what do you want to do to, you know, what's broken in our community and how can we as young people try to fix it? What would happen if there were thousands of kids who could do that?
And Youth Lead is moving long way towards the goal of having thousands of young people, they hope, becoming more and more tolerant of others. Thank you very much, Janet Penn, the head of Youth Lead. Before we leave, the story about Pope Francis's visit to the U.S. and the message of love and, of course, religious tolerance, we should catch up with International Edition's G. Abby Lee about what's being said on Twitter about the Pope's final day in the U.S. You know, G., all we know are certainly these hashtags, Pope in D.C. and the hashtag Pope in New York. What about the latest trending hashtags?
Hi, Steve. It's hashtag Pope in Philly. Pope Francis wrapped up his final Mass in America in Philly Sunday evening. Now, Steve, I said before that hashtag Pope in D.C. automatically generates an image of the U.S. Capitol in your tweet. And hashtag Pope in U.S. generates an image of the Pope with the American flag in the background. So it's only natural that hashtag Pope in Philly get its own image, too.
So, G, what kind of image does hashtag Pope in Philly generate?
It's an image of the Liberty Bell. I know it's not too familiar to our international audience, so I'm going to explain a little bit. It's a symbol of American independence from the British rule, and it's located inside the Independence Hall, which used to be the Pennsylvania State House.
Yes, and I want to add that it's now listed as a World Heritage Site. Are there any other trending hashtags related to the Pope's visit?
There is. Hashtag Pope in three words, that's number three in Arabic number, is also very popular today. Here are some examples. Leading by example, inspired by him, and last but not least, massive traffic jams. Now, many of these tweets also come with memes, so it was quite interesting to check them out.
I see. And what about some recommendations on Twitter accounts to follow?
Sure. We just heard from Jerome, and he has been live tweeting from Philly throughout Sunday. He's on Twitter at Jerome, S-O-C-O. My favorite from him was a picture of Pope Francis kissing a baby from his Pope Mobile on his way to the Mass. That's all for me today.
Oh, yeah, that was very sweet. Thanks, G. International Edition's G. Abby Lee. Of course, G. was referring to VOA religion correspondent Jerome Sokolowski. He's all over Twitter. And if you'd like to follow G on Twitter, she's all over Twitter as well. You can find her at G. Abby Lee. And, of course, you can follow International Edition at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Making the news, dozens are reported dead, scores others wounded following 2 days of sectarian violence in the Central African Republic. Fighting broke out in the capital of Bangui early Saturday as Muslims attacked a Christian neighborhood after the body of a dead Muslim was left near a mosque. A nighttime curfew was imposed. That violence erupted despite the presence of French troops and UN peacekeepers. It also comes ahead of presidential and parliamentary elections in the country, which are scheduled for October the 18th. The CAR has been plagued by sectarian violence, leaving thousands of dead and Seleka Muslim rebels. seized power in the mostly Christian nation back in 2013. Their abuses gave rise to the so-called anti-Balaka Christian militia. Thousands of people took part in a mass demonstration in the capital of the Republic of Congo, Brazzaville. That happened on Sunday to protest plans by longtime ruler Denis Sassou Nguesso to extend his rule. 71-year-old has ruled the country in two long stretches for more than 30 years, and the current constitution bars him from seeking a third consecutive term. Last week, he announced he would call a referendum on changes that could raise the minimum wage for presidential candidates and scrap the current two-term limit. Also in the news, in Sierra Leone, local health officials are quoted as saying the 42-day countdown to be declared Ebola-free has been launched for a second time, as the last two patients with the deadly virus were released on Sunday from the hospital. Following the latest outbreak in the north, hundreds were confined to their homes in Bombali and nearby Cambia districts. World Health Organization says the 42-day period, twice the incubation period, can commence once the latest known patient has tested negative twice for Ebola. You know, you can get more news at voanews.com. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Most people agree that there's something special about a baby smile. A new study finds that babies smile to get you to smile back, and they know exactly when to do it. The researchers found that, like successful comedians, babies have a great sense of timing, knowing just when to flash their smile to get a reaction from an adult. The research team, which included computer scientists, roboticists, and developmental psychologists, studied one-on-one interactions between mothers and their under 4-month-old children. Based on their observations, the researchers were able to program a childlike robot to smile at strategic intervals just like babies do. Then they had the robots interact with college student volunteers and found that the robot babies were just as successful as real babies in getting adults to smile. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Well, he made his fortune with the rock band The Eagles, but singer Don Henley has returned to his country roots. Did you know that? With a new CD. It's called Cass County. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us now, Henley got some high-profile help in a mix of new songs and some of those hurting tunes that formed his musical soul in East Texas.
Take a picture of this.
Don Henley is best known as the drummer and co-founder of the Eagles. But his solo albums, including Building the Perfect Beast, The End of the Innocents, and Inside Job, have added platinum records to his collection as well. On Cass County, Henley returns to his roots with rich lyrics and musicianship that break the modern country mold. He gets some help from the likes of Martina McBride, Miranda Lambert, Merle Haggard, Trisha Yearwood, Vince Gill, Dolly Parton, and Mick Jagger. The 68-year-old musician says that picking the right blend of voices was very much like casting a movie.
You know, and I was extremely fortunate in that nobody turned me down. You know, I was really delighted when Merle Haggard said yes, and when Mick Jagger said yes, and Dolly Parton, and all of them, you know.
You can get burned. You try to rekindle that old flame.
Henley released the first single off the album, That Old Flame, a duet with Martina McBride, to iTunes. The song speaks of two lovers who have rediscovered one another after several years, with the songwriter asking his one-time flame if it's him she misses or just her long-lost youth. Henley also has several covers that hearken to his youth in Linden, Texas, a town of 2,400 near the Arkansas and Louisiana borders. They include Jesse Winchester's The Brand New Tennessee Waltz, Jesse Lee Kincaid's 1966 single She Sang Hymns Out of Tune, and the Leuven Brothers' 1955 hit, When I Stop Dreaming, a duet with Dolly Parton. Henley says that recording with Parton was a special treat, even though the version of the song they did was higher than her comfort range.
She did a couple of takes, and she came back in the control room. She said, well, that key is a little high for me. I said, well, I'm sorry, that's just the key we've recorded in. She said, well, I'll just have to rear back and get it. And about two takes later, she had reared back and got it.
Don Henley also covers Tift Merritt's Bramble Rose with a little help from Miranda Lambert and Mick Jagger. Henley says that Jagger added just the right element to the song.
I was so thrilled and delighted when he agreed to do it. And the bonus about that is that he played that killer harmonica part, which I never would have thought of. It didn't occur to me at all, and I forgot what a great harp player he is. And it really added another texture and another color and a whole other dimension to the song.
Don Henley says he included the covers because he believes that music is getting away from its roots, and not just country music, but all genres. Authenticity is something the singer says he isn't hearing much right now, but fans can hear it from him on Cass County. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
Yeah, can you imagine Mick Jagger on a country album? Yeah, why not, I guess. If Dolly Parton can rear back, I guess Mick can do it too, huh? All right, thanks everyone for tuning in to The Voice of America today for International Edition. I'm going to pick up that CD. What about you, okay? Latest news straight ahead. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
South Sudan, the world's newest country and one of its least developed, faces many humanitarian challenges. Today, it suffers in the world's worst food security crisis, one caused primarily by man-made violence. More than two decades of North-South conflict, followed by factional fighting that erupted almost 2 years ago, have further weakened an already fragile nation and undermined its ability to protect and feed its people. The South Sudanese conflict has been particularly difficult on the civilian population. Thousands of people have been killed and more than 2.2 million driven from their homes. More than 600,000 have fled to neighboring states. Nearly 4.6 million, or 40% of the population, face acute hunger, particularly those living in the most conflict-affected areas of Unity, Upper Nile, and Jonglei states. Still, there is hope. In late August, the heads of the two warring parties signed a peace agreement that could bring an end to the fighting and set the country on a road to recovery. In view of this positive development, the United States has announced an additional $80 million in humanitarian assistance for the people of South Sudan, specifically aimed at helping South Sudanese refugees. This brings the total U.S. assistance since the start of the conflict to over $1.3 billion. The funding will aid those most in need, including internally displaced persons, refugees seeking asylum in South Sudan, and those South Sudanese who are living as refugees in neighboring nations. The United States urges all signatories of the peace agreement to uphold their obligations to the people of South Sudan and to allow immediate, full, and unconditional humanitarian access to all populations in need in all areas of South Sudan. They must also ensure the safety and security of civilians, humanitarian workers, and humanitarian supplies. There is a long road ahead, and this is the first step.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.